I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A complex world demands complex thinking. That's a message from a new book, Closing the Mind Gap, Making Smarter Decisions in a Hyper-Complex World. Its author, Ted Cadsby, joins me now. I'll get him to tell us about his book, the way we're thinking and the way we've always thought, and how we might get away from it to a new way of thinking for a far different world. Ted Cadsby is a corporate director, consultant, author, and speaker. He was long associated with CIBC as vice president of retail distribution, as well as president and CEO of CIBC Securities, chair of CIBC Trust, and chair of CIBC Private Investment Council. This new book is published by BPS Books. The website for more is at tedcadsby.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Ted Cadsby. Mr. Cadsby, good morning.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So yours is one of these books that you don't realize there's a problem until you think about the fact that there might be a problem, or you pick up this book because you're looking for something new. So set the scene for us, if you will. Tell us about what's going on when we're making decisions now.
Yes. Well, the title of the book, as you mentioned, is Closing the Mind Gap, and the gap originates from how we think about the world versus how the world really works when we confront complex problems. So we have developed very reliable intuitions about how things generally work, and that's how we've survived as a species for as long as we have and how we continue to survive. The problem is that the complexity in our world and our environment has dramatically increased and continues to grow at an exponential rate, such that the intuitive models that we use to interpret and the world and rely on and make reasonable decisions are no longer as consistently reliable as they have been because of the social complexity that we've created, of the complexity in terms of interconnectedness. And, of course, this dates back even before the agricultural revolution, but it certainly started to ramp up during the agricultural revolution as we became more independent with upon one another and specialized. And then, of course, it ramped up again in the industrial revolution and again in the information age that we're in now. And therefore, part of our frustration and part of our struggle, I argue, is the very fact that we have not, our thinking has in many ways not evolved fast enough to keep pace with the incredible complexity of our environment that we're operating in now. And that becomes our challenge, and that becomes the gap that that we need to close if we're going to be smarter and make smarter decisions in our new hyper-complex world.
So Ted, could you give us an example, say, of how we're making decisions now? And picking a question to answer, say. And then how we ought to be thinking about such problems.
Yeah. This issue of the mind gap, it relates to us on a personal level in our interpersonal relationships, in raising children, public policy, obviously, corporate strategy is a big one. And so, you know, what we normally do in our intuitive default way is to apply a very basic cause-effect model to the world where, you know, a single cause creates a single effect. So just as a very simple example, and talk about interpersonal relationships, if you say something that irritates me, I will tend to disregard the context of our conversation and label you or think of you as a person that I don't like. But a more sophisticated approach is to use what's called system theory, which comes out of a science that's only evolved in the last few decades from mathematics and then computer programming, which is called complexity science. And that applies a much more rigorous approach to analyzing cause-effect. And you don't have to be a mathematical genius or a complexity scientist to benefit from some of the concepts that complexity science has created, which I obviously go into some depth into the book in the book on. But to answer your question, Joe, the trick is to catch ourselves when we apply the simple cause-effect model and replace it with something that's much more elaborate, where we dig out the contextual clues that tell us what the multiple causes are and how they relate to each other, and how they in fact create effects that then again create the causes that influence them. So, for instance, in a very simple example of interpersonal relationships, and this is an obvious one, a complex thinker just doesn't stop at, well, this person is a jerk because he said or she said such and such. A complex thinker thinks, how is our interaction creating an environment that he or she is saying something that's irritating me? What am I doing to engage in a system of interaction, of discussion and behavior that's contributing to this effect that's irritating me? And so whether it's a business partnership, a marriage, or raising children, a systems mindset using complexity science where we analyze all of the complex factors that are interrelated and how they interrelate gives us a much, much more accurate picture of what's happening and helps us to avoid the overly simplistic approach that we'd otherwise take in addressing problems. And I'm using a very simple example in the case of an interpersonal relationship. Mm-hmm. But public policy is an obvious one. We tend to blame our politicians, and we tend to expect them to deliver very simple solutions for us, like a full-day kindergarten or taxing the rich more. And we gravitate to those politicians that seem to have simple solutions that we buy into, rather than demanding from them a greater degree of complexity in how they approach the problems and how they educate us on many of these public policy issues that we're facing today, whether it be global warming or the income disparity between rich and poor or increasing the education standards of our children. These are problems that are very they're very complicated, and they don't have single solutions that can be applied to them. And yet, we tend to demand simple solutions for our politicians, which puts us into a vicious cycle of implementing simple solutions which don't solve the problems. And so, as I say, whether it's interpersonal or public policy or organizational, this kind of what I call a complex thinking mindset can be extremely beneficial, in fact, even necessary to us surviving as a species, but certainly thriving in a much more effective way than we can if we just rely on our default intuition.
Now, if you have to go to complex thinking in terms of what's happening, say, when we make decisions, it's usually because there's some urgency to them. There's some time imperative. Do we have the time to engage in, say, the complexity science of why stuff's happening or why we feel why we feel?
It's a very good question. And the short answer is what we have to do is get much better at differentiating those problems or challenges that we need to make time for and those that are urgent enough that demand quicker solutions that we can still apply complexity science to, but we don't have the luxury of spending as much time deliberating on them. Mm-hmm. So the short answer to your question is, applying a complexity science mindset to a problem doesn't require a lot of extra time. It just requires a habitual use of models and thinking that once you become practiced in them, becomes fairly automatic for you. But it does take some practice to get used to them. But the second part of the answer to your question is, there are problems that don't greatly benefit from that kind of sophisticated thinking, mm-hmm. and there are problems that benefit, but we don't have a lot of time to deliberate on them, and they can still benefit, as I say, from that mindset, but it's going to be more of a quick and shortcut version of using complexity science rather than a more deliberate, long-standing effort. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that time-consuming, but the problem in the question that you've posed is that we are not designed to differentiate simple problems that require intuitive, quick answers from the more complex ones that require a lot more time and thinking by virtue of the fact that our brains are limited. We have limited energy resources. The way we think has been designed by evolution over years and years and years to be fairly circuitous and very imperfect in many ways. And if we take a more humble approach to how we solve problems, then we can differentiate better the ones that require a little more cognitive effort because they're the ones that we're vulnerable to oversimplifying and being overconfident in our conclusions of.
So our brains really haven't evolved quick enough, say the world has, in terms of how complex it's gotten from the agricultural revolution through the industrial revolution through to now the digital age. Is that right?
That is absolutely right, and it's quite fascinating because our thinking has definitely evolved very quickly.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, science is a great example, and there's only, you know, it wasn't that long ago that doctors didn't think of washing their hands before they operated. And, you know, and I was a child, and we're talking just a handful of decades ago when just for example, homosexuality was considered a psychiatric illness. So it's not that we haven't evolved. We do evolve. We continue to evolve. Our thinking is increasingly more sophisticated. But to your point, the complexity of the world we've created, especially in this information age of ours, has outstripped our ability to think about it in a sophisticated way. We're still operating on our default quick answers with great confidence, which works brilliantly if you're a hunter-gatherer, and it works pretty well for us on a day-to-day basis, even today. But it really can get us into difficulty on those situations that require a lot more mindful thinking and a lot more sophisticated approach based on, I mentioned, you know, some strategies in terms of applying more sophisticated models and the strategies that apply to more sophisticated decision-making. But we're not used to doing that, in part because during the day, our intuitive quick thinking works much of the time. So, you know, I'll draw you an analogy that I make in the book. We've outgrown our instinct for sugar and salt, especially salt in the form of fat. So, you know, historically, a craving for sugar was very useful because we would seek out fruit, which was healthy for us, and a craving for salt was important because we would seek out the protein and meat and the fat that was in the meat. Those cravings are still useful today. There's no doubt about it. Without a craving for sugar and salt, we wouldn't eat as well as we need to sustain ourselves. But the problem is, in today's environment, there's far too much sugary, fatty foods available to us, and hence we have an obesity epidemic. So it's not a matter of rejecting our instincts altogether. The analogy being how we think about simple problems, we still need the cut and dried shortcuts that we use cognitively, such as the very simple cause-effect model I described earlier. We still need those models to get through our day, to cross a busy street, to feed ourselves, and all the basics that we do. The problem is, same in the analogy of the sugar and the salt, it's too much of a good thing. And when it's over-applied to complexity and complex problems in our personal lives, public policy, organization, and so on, that's when we get into trouble, just as we do when we overeat sugar and salty, fatty foods. So it's a matter of differentiating the complex from the simple and applying a different thinking approach to the complex, which takes a little practice. But once you get the hang of it, and as I say in the book, once you start using these models and ways of thinking and catching yourself, it becomes second nature. I mean, speaking from personal experience, where, you know, I consider myself fairly adept at using some of these techniques because after researching and thinking about it, it's given me the opportunity to practice it and put it into a way in my life that makes me a more effective decision maker.
In terms of good decision making, as you suggest in the book, how much a role does foresight play into stuff, into the decision making process? And in taking the analogy about sugar and salt, if I'm hungry, I'll probably go for junk food because it's accessible to curb the hunger, the immediate hunger of the moment. But down the line, if I keep doing that every time I'm hungry, I'm going to have problems. So do you find that we don't think about down the road, say, as much?
Yes, we are very, very crass and simple when it comes to predicting and forecasting. And I have a good piece of a book that you've alluded to that relates to predictions and forecasts. We are notoriously very poor forecasters. And this comes to pundits we hear on the television or radio or podcasts who are predicting, you know, how international affairs are likely to play out. This comes to picking mutual funds. My background initially in my career was as an executive in the investment industry, and it's quite amazing how stock pickers and people who buy mutual funds are very poor predictors of what future performance will look like based on prior performance. And not only are we very poor at it, but to your point, it takes a bit of cognitive effort to think through all the possible possibilities that can come out of a particular decision. We tend to be very narrow in our approach, and part of the solution to complex thinking is being a little broader, and what I call broadening the spotlight of our narrow attention, because our attention is designed to be very narrow. But to be a complex thinker, it behooves us to broaden that spotlight. And then part of the broadening of the spotlight is, as you say, trying to think through what the possible effects are for any given cause, because we tend to underestimate, you know, all the possible consequences of our decisions without having given them enough thought in advance. But part of it comes back to also recognizing how poor predictors we are, and coming up with backup plans, plan Bs and plan Cs. If our decisions don't pan out, then what's our alternative strategy? We tend not to think that way. And it really, truly behooves us to think that way in this day of complexity, especially with some of the bigger issues we're facing. But also, as I say, on a personal level, developing our careers, raising our families, having satisfying relationships with other people, these are all areas where a little bit of extra cognitive effort can go a long, long, long way to having a lot more success and satisfaction in our lives.
Yeah, we tend to oversimplify things. We have this addiction to certainty, as you talk about in the book. This reliance to, say, forecasters and the sort really does make us lazy, and I guess that, in effect, affects our thinking.
It does. In fact, I'm glad you brought up the addiction to certainty, because I speak quite a bit about that, obviously, in the book. And it's quite interesting. We are physiologically and psychologically geared to rush to certainty as quickly as possible. In other words, we actually feel very uncomfortable and, in fact, secrete stress hormones in the form of cortisone and adrenaline when we don't understand something that we think is fairly important that we have to figure out. And the reason being is because we don't feel that we're in control when we don't understand. And all animals, especially the higher primates, do not like feeling out of control. So our biology and our psychology is geared towards rushing to conclusion. And guess what? That is a brilliant survival strategy when you're on the savanna and you have to be alert to the possible dangers, the predators, and the opportunities for food. But rushing to conclusion in the case of public policy such as global warming or the income disparity between rich and poor, as I mentioned, or perhaps even more importantly in our own personal lives, judging other people, interacting with other people, making career decisions for ourselves. Rushing to certainty is one of our biggest problems. In fact, what I tend to say is, you know, when we look at ourselves, we can describe ourselves as being irrational, overreactive, we're innumerate, we're illogical, we're unreasonable, but as I say in the book, the two most significant and interesting of our cognitive frailties, I believe, is one, how we oversimplify everything, and two, how overconfident we are in those oversimplified interpretations. And the catch is that for straightforward problems, and the kind that we have confronted as a species for, you know, generation upon generation upon generation, our quick and dirty conclusions are usually good enough. But when it comes to, you know, modern-day problems, the quick and dirty conclusions are not good enough. They tend to be grossly oversimplified. And to add to that problem, we tend to be far too overconfident in them. In other words, we tend to lock down on our conclusions prematurely without giving enough thought to alternatives and alternative possible interpretations. And as I say, this really shows up in our interpersonal relationships, but we're very quick to label people because we've been ingrained with a tribal instinct and an instinct for status and an instinct for intra-group cooperation, but inter-group competitiveness, all of which were very helpful for us and many of our generations, but are outdated today in the same way that our craving for sugar and our craving for salt can get us into trouble. So we have to be very mindful of our tendency to oversimplify and our tendency to be overconfident in the way that we rush to certainty and rush to conclusion.
The book has a lot of research in terms of say different disciplines, psychology, anthropology, philosophy, physics. How do you get, what was happening in your life that you got to this way of thinking? And then were you always interested in this sort of research that you provide in the book? And then thus came these ideas that are now in here?
Yeah, I'll give you, it's a really interesting question, and I'll give you the answer in as short a way as I can. As a young child, I was fascinated by religion. I was brought up in a fairly secular home, and I guess it always caused me to question some of the friends I had, why their beliefs were so fundamentally different than mine. And in fact, when I was in junior high, one of my closest friends was a Jehovah's Witness, and we spent hours and hours arguing and discussing his interpretation of God and my interpretation, which is a much more secular view of the world. But I always struggled to understand why could it be that someone would have such a different view of reality than me. And I guess, you know, fast forwarding many decades, when I was head of a mutual fund company, I became fascinated at the investment decision-making process that people undertook and how self-sabotaging they were, how poor their decision-making was when it came to stock picking and mutual funds, and how unintuitive randomness was. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how we are very easily deceived by randomness, and randomness plays such a big part in our lives, much bigger and much more profoundly than we tend to give it credit for being. And that shows up when people chase after mutual fund returns, but it also shows up in all areas of business and, in fact, in our lives. So combining that initial confusion and curiosity about how people could have such disparate views of reality with a later day point in my career where I was baffled but intrigued by how people could be so irrational and incorrect in their interpretation of something like the stock market got me fascinated in a field called behavioral economics, which is in fact the people that is the focus of how people make poor financial decisions. And from that grew a broader interest. And I thought my first two books were, one was on index investing, and the second was on behavioral economics in particular. And then beyond that, I just continued my research out of the investment and finance industry to look at cognitive science more broadly and complexity science, which provides some of the solutions. So as I outline in the book, I kind of categorize the solutions to mirror the two problems that I mentioned earlier. We oversimplify, and therefore we need more sophisticated models, and that's where complexity science comes into play. And we're overconfident, and therefore we need better decision-making strategies, and that's where cognitive science or psychology comes more into play, so we can understand how we make decisions and how we can catch ourselves and be more robust in how we approach decisions. So it's kind of a twofold solution to a twofold problem. More sophisticated models so we don't oversimplify, and more sophisticated decision-making techniques so we're not overconfident and jumping to our first conclusions based on our rush and our addiction to certainty.
Well, you're talking to me from Ontario today.
Yes.
You there are in the midst of an election campaign.
Yes.
Writ periods are short. They're about a month or so.
Yes.
Elections are important, obviously.
Yes.
So you've already alluded to earlier about the decision-making that voters will have to do.
Yes.
How do you get your way of thinking? into the, say, the public discourse, into the political realm, so that better decisions are made, one, by the elected officials, and two, by the voters themselves?
I've written on this topic, and my general view is that we, as the electorate, have to be much more demanding of our politicians that they don't cater to our base instincts for quick, simple solutions. In other words, we have to take ownership over this problem by demanding greater complexity and sophistication in how they educate us on the issues and how they propose solutions. I gravitate to politicians who are not prone to quick fixes and who are more inclined to engage the public in dialogue about the intricacies of public policy and some of the implications of certain decisions and what the trade-offs are. No decision has a negative trade-off. Every decision we make, including those that politicians and public policymakers make, have negative trade-offs. And those are the ones that we have to be educated and understand and willing to accept. But I don't blame the politicians entirely, because I think they cater to what we demand of them. And what I try to advocate to people is that we have to be demanding a greater level of sophistication in how these conversations happening. And we should really try to turn our backs on politicians who are condescending to us to the extent that they offer quick slogan solutions to things. I find that anathema to, you know, a democratic process. And I really find myself resisting politicians who oversimplify difficult decisions. I don't know if you remember, it was going back a little while, a couple decades ago, when Kim Campbell was running for re-election as prime minister, and she said something to the effect of elections are a difficult time to engage in deep public policy discussions.
Right.
And I was, and she really got crushed for that. I think there was an element of genuine, authentic truth in what she was saying. Now, she didn't approach it the right way, and she was kind of giving up on the whole objective of educating the public, which is, you know, not the right solution or the right approach. But she was identifying a true problem that we haven't yet solved, which is that politicians are elected on the basis of public appeal, and unfortunately, their appeal is often very highly correlated to quick solutions, of which there are many that we've experienced, both across the country and in Ontario, that end up being enormous wastes of money and also have many poor side effects. So we just have to be a lot more demanding of our politicians that they take the time to educate us. If we want simple bromides, that's what we'll get. But if we demand greater sophistication in how they engage us, then that's what they'll have to do.
Yeah, this is such fascinating stuff in this book, Ted. Continued good luck with this book, and thanks for this.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about it.
You're very welcome. The website for more, tedcadsby.com. The book is called Closing the Mind Gap, Making Smarter Decisions in a Hyper-Complex World. BPS Books is its publisher. Ted Cadsby joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.